Raise your hand if you've watched or are watching Squid Game. It's an interesting concept, but poorly executed. And the concept is, of course, as old as the movie Battle Royale and older the idea of people competing to the death, which one reviewer points out is not so unusual. Football players and boxers die of their competition quite often. But it raises some of the more unsavory aspects of human nature, what our sages would call midat stom, the often translated as the attributes or moral comportment of the sodomites. And the writer Renato Lings uses the interesting translation. Sometimes you learn something very interesting just from translation, calling it the yardstick of stom, the way things were measured in Sodom and Gomorrah, these evil and atomistic, personalistic, and non-communitarian ways they viewed each other. Selfish and zero-sum was the view of Sodom and many of the cities of the plain, which are introduced in this week's parasha and will become more front and center next week. And I often return to this question, what do we do with things that we might consider at the very least unsavory, discomforting, morally at best ambivalent, and at worst noxious, in our Parshiot, in our Torah, in our Tanakh, in our Talmud, and other sources? And I'll give you a short and difficult list, just in this week's parasha alone, of midat stom, these things cut by the yardstick of stom, measured out, to quote T.S. Eliot, in coffee spoons. So as Abraham, or Abram as he's then known, comes through Egypt, he's so afraid of the people's wrath upon him and their lust after his wife Sarai that he asks her, begs her, to conceal herself. And in Midrashim, she is literally concealed, and in Torah, she is just disguised as his sister. And through her, he gains many properties, which at some level, if not explicitly, considers that he prostituted her. It's repugnant to us, and perhaps all the more repugnant in an older society of honor and shame, where one's wife's, one's sister's, one's daughter's honor and candidly virginity was a mark of the man's prowess and importance and moral character. And the act of prostituting his wife for his material success and his physical safety should be abhorrent in any age. And then we move on to Lot and Abram's conversations about which way to go and what parts of the land they would settle. And Lot chooses the plains, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and a few others, because he recognizes or believes them to be plains of rich and fertile land, great places for pasturage of animals. But it's known that they are wicked. In this week's parasha, it's explicitly stated that these are already known to be wicked and unpleasant places. That is, he chooses sort of the urban life of danger and moral decay over, you know, the gentle and quiet life of the farm, one might say, to use sort of 1960s language. He chooses wealth over spiritual success. And to return to this idea of midat stom, which is really our sages understand each person for him or herself. It's not a selfishness or a grasping after another's property, but an unwillingness to support each other or to recognize the mutuality of life. There is strife, there is combat, there is disagreement between Abram's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen in chapter 13. And the Midrash says that the cattle of Abraham would go about muzzled, but Lot's cattle would go about unmuzzled, which is to say, I think they would grasp at, take at, eat upon, and fight anything they could grasp, anything they could reach, where Abram was considerate of his cousin, but also his neighbor. Right? That there was a sense that we can't take all we want. We take what we need, but not all we want. I'm not quoting the Communist Manifesto here, but I am recognizing our tradition's understanding of communitarianism, that human nature, human society, is not each person for her or himself, but that we rely on each other and that our actions honestly affect each other. And the alternative is strife. The alternative is civil war. The alternative is civic disagreement. The alternative is combat. Diplomacy by another means. There is, of course, the five kings against the four kings battles in chapter 14 of our parasha, a multi-principality war or rebellion, however it would be understood historically. And that, I think, is the ultimate outcome of narcissism, of selfishness, of self-seeking, and awareness only of one's own welfare. What's interesting in this day and age is, of course, I pointed out how narcissistic we've become. But in these times of threat and distress and trauma, there is a very human impulse to withdraw into oneself, to take care graspingly, sometimes violently, of one's own. So much so that I've heard more than one story about fights breaking out at Little League games. That we look out for ourselves, that we look out for our families, that we look out for our narrow bandwidth and understanding of what matters, and fail in an effort to reach beyond Midat Stom, that weak, personalized, narrow yardstick. And this is true not just in what we take, but even in how we understand what we have, how we understand our own prowess and capacity, how we understand property rights, how we understand acquisitiveness. So at the end of the wars, Abram is offered wealth, Abram is offered gift, and he says, I'm not going to take a thread or a shoe strap, nor I take anything that's yours. He understands himself, it doesn't say it explicitly, to be a self-made human, right? He doesn't want the others to say that they were the cause of Abram's success. But implicit in that is that he's not self-made, that he's God-made, that his success is derived from his compact, his covenant, his brit with the Almighty, and that each of us benefit from gifts and accidents of birth, from accidents of geography, from accidents of zip code, from accidents of parental education, from accidents of physical prowess. That was also implicit in the show, which I ultimately don't recommend, called Squid Game. And then I think this plays out civically, most powerfully, in environmental experiences. Not just small e environment of the places we live, but large e environment of climate change, deforestation, natural resource incursion, lack of food security, lack of weather security. We see that in the parasha where Lot's men and Abram's men and their families overuse the land and so are forced to divide up the land and find separate portions for each other, when one might have imagined if they'd been more careful in their stewardship of the places, they could have coexisted. It's not certain, but possible. A friend tells me that Richard Powers has a novel called Overstory that makes this point explicitly and talks about it further in a podcast with Ezra Klein, the journalist and author, which I recommend. And as a recent homeowner, I wonder if anyone else has had this experience, this awareness as you look over your yard, your home, of the absurdity of owning it, right? Like, you have property rights. Legally, I believe in them. I believe in very strong assessment of property rights. From John Locke on, I believe in American understandings of property rights. Of course, in Israel, you can only lease the land of Israel. But I'm not sure, as much as I think that it's a cornerstone of the rule of law, I'm not so sure that morally and certainly spiritually we can own land or property. If you think about our brief lifetime and what happens to our bicycles and cars and lawn after we die, it kind of belies the idea that it's all ours anyway. It doesn't remain to us, as the shroud has no pockets. But this idea of property rights plays out in this week's parasha, and the midrash of this week's parasha pushes it further in the ways that one might acquire land, contra to how one acquires land in Israel. The broad concept is that if you walk the field, says the anonymous author of Midrash Rabbah, whether along the length or the breadth, you acquire it as far as you walk. And Rabbi Eliezer, in contrast, in the name of the sages, say, you do not acquire it until you take possession in some sort of physical manner, which there's a whole tractate, not a tractate, but a whole legal discourse on kinyan, an acquisition. And in this week's parsha, it's called the achuzat olam, sort of a heritable property and a legacy. But again, lurking below all that is the absurdity of ownership. The idea that you can own anything more than your body and breath seems, at one level, at the level of dream and myth and spirituality, and some would say Native American understandings, preposterous, fanciful, right? And our tradition highlights that even one's body is not one's own. So I want to offer, as toward conclusion, a different model. When Abram gathers his retainers and other tribes, other chieftains, to engage with him in battle and engage with him in sort of civic administration, they're called Baalei Brit. Baal means someone who is owner of, master of, or participant in. Brit. We translate Brit as covenant, but I'm almost certain in that section, which I think was chapter 14, it means allies. It means allies, allegiance, people who are under a compact with each other, people who are under an entente or a detente, or, you know, North American treaty organization, a treaty. And this idea of allyship, which we often talk about in modern circles as being, you know, allyship to people of color, allyship to gay persons when one is not a person of color, when one is not gay, allyship to the poor. I think that's what it's getting at, is understanding oneself to be tied, that Brit is not just covenant, is not just compact, is not giving back and forth, certainly not contract in an enforceable or limited way, but being an ally, being a partner to, in a broader sense. And a partner to the idea that, to use the Talmudic idea, that when one profits, another doesn't have to suffer. When one gains, another doesn't necessarily lose, that is the best of all worlds. That's the ideal we strive for, not midat stom, not the idea that each person for her or himself. And I think that's implicit in this week's parsha as well. We have this statement that Hagar will lowly esteem Sarai once Hagar bears Ishmael, and Sarai is still without child. But there's an alternative even in the parsha, that when the angel assures Sarai and assures Hagar that they will each have a heritage, a legacy, they will each give birth to 12 chieftains, 12 tribes of Israel and 12 tribes of the Ishmaelites, who later might be understood to be Arab, although that's not certain that that's what the Torah is teaching. And there's a gematria, a numerical understanding of the two words, Hagar, mother to Ishmael, and Yitzhak, child of Sarai, that they are in some way equivalent, that contra Esav and Jacob, contra Ephraim and Manasseh, one gift, one blessing doesn't imply that there's not blessing for the other. And so I'll conclude with the oddest image, the most complicated and hard to follow image, I think, of the parsha and maybe even of Genesis. The covenant between the parts, the brit between the parts, the allyship, the relationship, the partnership between the parts. So Abram takes several animals, cuts them in halves, and walks through them in a sort of dreamlike state, in awe at God's power. Resources suggest that what that meant is, should I break this covenant with you, God, may I be cut in half. But there's a beautiful understanding through Rashi in Midrash, the medieval sage Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, that it was the custom of those times that two people who wished to pledge everlasting friendship and devotion to each other conducted a ceremony in which they passed together between the divided halves of a slaughtered animal, symbolizing that just as the two halves are in truth a single creature, so to their persons, ostensibly two distinct persons, two distinct beings, are henceforth regarded as a single entity. That smoking furnace, which represents the Almighty, passed between the parts with Abram, that it was there that I carried you, where there are only one set of footsteps. This possibility, and I think at some level reality, that there is no split, that the world is not to be divided, but to be shared, and that if we take what we need, others can have what they need. And if we are modest and considerate, compassionate and communitarian with our use of the earth and of its resources and properties, there'll be more than enough safety and security for all.